Today on Inside Utah Politics, Utah lawmakers are heading toward the finish line for the 2025 legislative session. Our panel looks at the biggest decisions still to be made in these final days. Plus, changes to the mail-in voting overhaul are here, but were they enough to please the county clerks? Two clerks from some of the state's largest counties weigh in. And a push to tighten medical malpractice lawsuit rules turns heads. We've got your Capitol Hill headlines grabbing attention this late in the session.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrts.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Lindsay Ehrts, live on location at the Utah State Capitol, and let's go inside Utah politics. Now, it's a busy week here on Capitol Hill, of course, with just 5 days left of the session. Lawmakers are working on finalizing bills, passing budgets, and addressing any lingering issues before this session ends. One of the biggest questions, though, is what will tax cuts look like, and will they happen for a fifth year in a row? Joining me now, Sarah Real. She's a member of the State Board of Education, and Chris Blake with RRJ Consulting, a consulting firm and lobbyist up here at the Capitol. Thank you both for being with me.
Absolutely.
All right, let's dive in. Some major rocks to lift before we finish the session in the next 8 days. Tax cuts are one of the biggest ones that lawmakers are still sorting out. Sarah, let me start with you. They're eyeing an income tax cut right now, reducing that rate from 4.55% to 4.5%. That would save about $97 million. Or I should say, go back to taxpayers, and that would be $97 million less we have in our state budget. Is that the right proposal right now in a year where they've already said revenue estimates are tight?
I was opposed to the tax cuts last year, and I think that with the instability, with what's going on in the federal government, and first to say, I've always appreciated how fiscally conservative the state has been, and I've always really appreciated how we've done our budget. I don't think now is a time for tax cuts. I think there are a lot of great opportunities for a big tax cut, but I think cutting Social Security tax, like the governor's proposed, great idea. Other, like a child tax credit, I think is also a great idea, but doing a lump, even though it's small, tax cut again this year doesn't seem like a good idea to me.
Well, Chris, the argument from lawmakers has been $45 the average family might save this year, times that by five over the last 5 years that we've done this, including this one. That adds up. Is that how you see this?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And, you know, the legislature has a feeling that they want to lower the income tax rate. They want to get that as low as possible for competitive reasons, and they're going to continue to push on that. As Sarah talked about, they're looking at including a Social Security increase. I don't think they'll remove it entirely, a child tax credit, some other things that they're looking at. But I think they want to continue to push that rate lower. That's something the Speaker and President have spoken about, and they're going to continue to push on. I want to just say the legislature set aside this money at the beginning, recognizing that there was likely going to be some revenue volatility. Sarah's right, you know, it's even probably more volatile right now with what's going on in DC. But I think they have recognized that from the beginning. If they were really concerned, we wouldn't be seeing them push forward on that.
Why shouldn't we save that pot of money or apply it somewhere else or not take it from the education fund? Why should we not save that money?
You know, the one thing, and Sarah talked about this, one thing the legislature has done really well, particularly over the last 10 to 15 years, but even going back further than that, they have lots of money socked up in places that they could dive into if they needed it. And so I don't think they're as stressed about the revenue projections as maybe some have led on to believe. If they had concerns, I don't think they'd do it, but they also have places they can go to, both substantial rainy day funds, money in the Transportation Investment Fund, and other places that they've sort of socked away money to make sure that it's right. They believe money needs to be going back to the taxpayers, and that's kind of where they're focused.
And important to note that our overall state budget is still growing, right?
Correct.
So the revenue projections are down, like what we thought we might get are down, but overall the state is still growing. But Sarah, to Chris's point where they have continued to cut the income tax, for our viewers who don't know, that money comes from education because the income tax is solely earmarked to go to public education, higher education, and some social services. How do we replace that fund if we are continuing to bring it down?
Well, we would need to adjust how some of the things that we're funding in education. For example, we have a school safety bill. We all want our schools to be safe. I think there's a lot of great things in that bill. It is very expensive. Is all of the infrastructure and the requirements of the school safety bill, should that be coming out of the education fund or should it be coming from somewhere else? That adds a little bit more revenue, just tiny chips away. For me, it's we're thinking about how we're going to fund education and how we're prioritizing what we're funding within education. And for me this year, I feel like we've done some great things and we're seeing some projections about the increase of the WPU, et cetera. But I'm not completely convinced that we're prioritizing the right items.
Yeah, Chris, how do you feel about that? When we continue to bring down the income tax cuts, either we got to raise our sales taxes or our property taxes go up because
legalize marijuana or get the lottery.
Yeah, there's other ways to make money in this state. Yeah.
Those are some novel ideas, yeah. I think, that Sarah's proposed. One of the things that I look at as, and one of the changes that I've seen over the last 20 years around budgeting, they are front loading a lot of the money towards education. So they've already did, if I'm not mistaken, a 4% WPU in the base budget. Back when I worked for the legislature, if we hit 4% WPU in some years, that would have been like the major cause celeb. And now they're just doing that and funding the growth and funding inflationary costs. So before the session even started, they put over, I think it was close to $250, $300 million into the education pot, which is not insignificant. They're going to grow it some more, but there are always going to be more needs, even more wants than they have the ability to fund. And so I think what they've done is really responsible in terms of making sure that public education is continuing to grow, has additional money to meet not only the needs of our students, but as Sarah points out, like the school safety bill, that is putting some real costs on our districts and our charter schools, and there are some concerns there, some valid ones.
Another one would be the Utah Fits All scholarship that's appropriating about $40 million. I mean, that all has to be approved, but that's the estimate right now.
Yeah, and to add on to what Chris was saying, I mean, I think that in the education, I'm speaking for myself, not the whole board, but in the education environment, we're grateful for all of those increases, especially after the recession. It's taken us a lot of time to catch up, right? But it's we have created so much over-regulation in education, so many requirements, which require more staff, more FTEs. We just keep putting more on education, including a lot of mental health services, which probably should be coming out of healthcare. It should be a healthcare thing, not an education piece. And so even though we're grateful for the increase in the WPU and the consistent funding and the increase in funding, I think that it's looking at how much burden are we placing on our LEAs and our schools and our entire system, and is education taking a lot of that on? And if they are, on top of a lot of the new regulations and laws that have been passed over the last 5 years, we're needing more staff. We have to do a lot more requirements, we have a lot more data that we're processing, and technology changes, which technology is in the classroom. So that's also expensive. So it's not that education isn't frugal. I think education is very frugal. I've spent my whole career in education. But we just have a great need for more resources.
And I think Sarah's point here is really important. We are putting a lot of demand on our teachers and our schools, our administrators, and balancing that off the increase in costs is something that they're really going to need to spend some time on, I think, going forward. Are we putting too much on our teachers? Is the expectations too high relative to what we're able to fund them? And that's a real concern.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, let's switch now to another hot topic up here at Capitol Hill, which is judicial reform. We had hundreds of lawyers come out this week and oppose a slew of bills that the legislature is proposing, arguing that they infringe on the independence of the judicial branch. Now, lawmakers argue it is within our constitutional purview to do this. The Constitution provides for us to dictate how, in statute, some of the judicial pieces operate, right? So I guess the question for you, Chris, has the legislature gone too far? Are we encroaching on separation of powers, or is this just, you know, within their purview, they're allowed to do it?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the legislative branch from a couple of perspectives. One, I think it should be a strong institution, and they have some important responsibilities. They're part-time, and so they have a short period of time where they get to sort of flex their muscles. And there are some tensions and problems and between conflicts between the judiciary and the legislative branch. It's clear. And I don't have a problem with that tension playing out. The judiciary has made some decisions that the legislature doesn't like. Legislature is exerting its opportunity to push back and say, you know, we have some concerns about the direction you're going. But I'm also a big believer that the legislative process works itself out. The judiciary should share their concerns lawyers should be sharing their concerns as it impacts them. And I suspect that it will work out in the end and maybe readjust some of that balance. But I don't have any specific concerns that I think are problematic. And I'm a believer that the process works through and generally gets to good results.
This might be our first time disagreeing. I'm going to make a sports analogy. Mm-hmm. I think that the legislature is governing a lot like Diana Taurasi right now. A bully, pushing folks around. And I wish they governed a little bit more like Sue Bird. More team player, more of a listener, moving the ball around in a better way that suits the whole team. Lots of assists. And right now, I feel like a lot of my concerns with the legislature aren't necessarily deep into policy, but it's the way that they're governing. I teach political science and I talk about the foundations of our Constitution and the importance of separation of powers and the importance of checks and balances. And I believe, like Chris was saying, that it does work out generally, but I've been frustrated with a lot of the way that the legislative branch has been exerting power. I could make a list of folks who are scared to speak up or scared to ask or scared to engage even because they're worried about retributions. They're worried about retaliation. And I mean, from the governor's office to education to the city of Salt Lake to Salt Lake County, I mean, the list goes on and on. And I think that's really troubling because with a supermajority, it's really not making it balance in the way it should be. And I think that the Utah Bar Association and all the lawyers, the nonpartisan lawyers that came out and said their concerns, I think those are really valid. And I hope that it does work out through the legislative process. And I hope that they do listen to the concerns of all of the nonpartisan lawyers.
So with all of that as the backdrop, there's one specific proposal that would create a committee of lawmakers who could make judicial retention recommendations on the ballot. Chris, is that too far or is that something that the legislature should be able to do and give, you know, as they say, voters another avenue of information? Because I think we all agree that we don't have enough information when it comes to retention of judges, right? And that's what they say they're trying to do. But having lawmakers put their recommendations on the ballot, is that the right approach?
Yeah, I think the legislature is Caitlin Clark in this regard and just taking their deep shot. So I just want to respond to Sarah here. I was here when Representative Kurt Oda adjusted judicial retention elections back probably in 07, 08 in that time frame. And I remember there being a lot of consternation that the legislature was going too far. These things need to be constantly looked at because the reality is we all get our ballots and we look at them and we see a bunch of names on a ballot. And it's like, what am I supposed to do with this? I don't know who this person is. You know, there are some resources out there that are available. But I think this is just one of those constant checks that needs to be recalibrated and looked at from time to time. Are the judges operating the way that they should be? And, you know, do I think the legislature is going too far? Until I see the finished product, no. And I think that but this was the same sort of talking points they used 15 years ago to say they're going too far, they're encroaching in this, and the process has continued to work well. We have a good judicial system. I'm a believer in it. We have a good process for nominating judges. And we don't have partisan elections. I mean, that would be a place where I'd be more concerned. And so I don't think the legislature is going in a direction that is problematic. It's just they're pushing against each other and trying to find the right spot to end in.
We'll have to leave it there. We'll watch all of these big rocks being lifted in the last week of the session. Chris Blake and Sarah Real, thank you so much for joining me. Coming up next, a pair of county clerks not supporting a big new election bill. We'll have that coming up.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Welcome back. Well, a massive elections bill that will require voters to include the last four digits of their ID when they send in their ballot finally dropped this week. This new version of HB 300 also requires ballots to be into the clerk's office by 8 p.m. on election night. And voters will have until 2028 to opt in to get a ballot by mail. But two of Utah's largest county clerks tell me they have concerns. Davis County Clerk Brian McKenzie and Salt Lake County Clerk Lanny Chapman, thank you both for joining me. Okay, this big elections bill, HB 300, is really a talker, and this will have significant impacts for Utah voters, both from the voter side and elections administrations, which is why you two are both here. Brian, I want to start with you. Do the clerks support this bill as it is right now?
HB 300 is a significant bill in the way that it will impact the voters of the state of Utah. We've been actively working with the sponsor on the bill. working to try to make some improvements. While some improvements have been made, still some critical concerns need to be resolved in this bill. So currently, no, clerks do not support this bill.
Okay, interesting. So dive into those concerns for me. What are the biggest pieces that the clerks feel like will impact voters here?
Yeah, a couple of areas. One is, you know, the idea is to propose and move the state forward with an opt-in or opt-out of a vote-by-mail process. That so much is not the issue, but it's how that's implemented. The short amount of time, the implementation timeline, there's some significant concerns on how to get to that point. Other areas of concerns are some changes in the voter ID laws. What is and is not sufficient for valid voter identification that can have some unanticipated consequences on our voters. What we want to do is, if the state of Utah is going to be making these significant policy shifts in how people vote, we want to make sure that we are minimizing the negative impacts on our voters.
So, Lanny, dive into that for me. What is it about the ID and the implementation of using your ID when you vote, when you cast your ballot? I know we do it at registration, but what is it about the ID at that point that's problematic for the clerks?
Sure, there's a lot of points there. First and foremost, it's going to extend the amount of time it takes us to administer processing to ensure that you are who you say you are, which we already do. This does add that level of security, but with that comes a huge time and resource component, right? We want to be fiscally responsible stewards of taxpayer dollars. In order to accomplish this successfully, we're going to have to increase the amount of people that work with us. That includes training, and there's a huge time component, making sure that we're sending or that we're properly verifying all of these ballots. The Wasatch Front, there are so many voters, this is going to add time, resources, and I know we also want efficient results. We want quick results. This is not going to give us that. In order for us to be able to do what we need to do and follow the law as it's written right now, it's serious uphill battle.
Okay, so what is it about the, it's not so simple as we write the last four digits of our ID, you guys scan it or put it in. I mean, you have a machine called the Agilis machine that allows you to kind of take a picture of the signature and do an initial evaluation of that signature. But you're saying that machine doesn't actually capture the numbers. You can't just, you know, read those numbers. So it's not as simple as just, well, we have the ID number, so we should be able to verify the voter.
Yeah, currently that technology doesn't exist. So for a county like Salt Lake County with over 615,000 active registered voters, I'm going to have to hand look at each one of those. And let's say, for instance, somebody doesn't have the last four correctly written on there. I'm going to have to reject that ballot, send it to CURE, challenge it, have them take more steps so that I can accurately count it, even if the signature does match what we have on file.
So, Brian, I know you've been heavily involved in the negotiations with lawmakers. How do you solve for that problem, and are they open to solving that problem?
Yeah, from what we're hearing from the legislature, one of their key policies that they're trying to tackle is increasing the confidence level in the verification of the voter at the time of voting. And I think if you talk with the county clerks, we're in support of that. That's an important component, and I think everybody is. We want to make sure that before we count a ballot, that ballot was indeed cast by the voter. Now, again, the original idea was very complicated. This idea of requiring somebody to go and deliver their ballot in person, that just didn't work. This is an alternative idea, and we believe that it is an idea that would have minimal impact on our voters. But we do recognize, as Lanny has pointed out, that it is going to require more time. It is going to require more resources, and there is going to be a cost component in that. Now, again, that's the policy question, right, that the legislature has to decide. What our job is to make sure that we accurately present that to them to where they understand the impacts and the result of this action.
So what is the biggest issue with the providing ID from your perspective? How does that, I mean, you said earlier that really will impact all of Utah voters and sort of the main reason you oppose the bill.
Yeah, I think right now it's the timing and the implementation to make sure that we provide adequate time for the voters to understand the shift, the change in how they're going to interact with the voting process, making sure that there's as little disruption and interruption for the voter. And really, that's where some of our greatest concerns are. Now, talking about the ID component, there's a modification in the types of voter ID that would be acceptable. Here in the state of Utah, you know, we've had voter ID laws in place since at least 2005. They've been great laws. We have primary IDs that include your passport, your driver's license, military IDs, tribal identification cards, things like that. And then we have a secondary method for identifying. What's important to recognize is the way that we've approached voter ID laws here in the state of Utah is this balance between security and accessibility. Maintaining that is a critical component of anything that we do with elections.
So the runway to opt in to vote by mail, which right now in the bill it's 2028 by that election, you're saying that doesn't give you enough time.
2028 is a significant year. It's a presidential year. That's the year that we have 90%+ of our voters voting and participating. And there's a percentage of our voters that just don't vote in other elections until the presidential year. That's the percentage that we believe will be most impacted by this. If they miss because whatever their choice is for not participating in other elections, and then we show up on a presidential year and have 20, 30, or 40% of our voting population that does not understand this change, and then all of a sudden they don't get a ballot. That's where our concern is. That's one of the ways that our voters will be negatively impacted. We would much rather see that expanded out, or maybe there's some different ways to approach that. But again, our goal is, again, if the legislature wants to get to this policy, we can provide suggestions on how to get to that point, minimizing a negative impact for our voters.
What is the issue with the voter rolls that lawmakers believe aren't clean enough?
Great question. I think during the last legislative audit, there were some findings that there were people on our rolls that were no longer alive. That has to do a lot with the role that vital statistics plays with the election system. And it's something that we are currently working on fixing. However, at the end of the day, you have to remember, if we don't know somebody has passed away, there's no way for us outside of our normal ability when we remove people from the rolls for not participating in elections to know that they're no longer alive. So it's going to take a village. And again, the beehive state, that's something that we're used to doing, making sure that we all can work together to make sure that we're running the best elections we can. And that's something that I think we have to keep in mind.
Brian, leave us with our final thoughts here in terms of what you want to see fixed, changed, to get on board with supporting this bill and make it the best bill so voters can vote.
If I can, I want to address one thing with
yes.
voter registrations. So in the state of Utah, while we are not perfect and we recognize that, we should tell our citizens and make sure that our voters understand the voter registration rolls in the state of Utah are amazingly clean. Even from the legislative audit, we found that 99.90% of our voter registration rolls are accurate. We have some improvements, we want to work on those, and we're committed to making sure that those are clean. As it relates to HB 300, what would I really love to see? We are actively working within the Senate. Our goal is to help the legislature meet their policy goals that they want to accomplish, but do it in a way that does not negatively impact our voters.
We'll watch to see how this progresses. Davis County Clerk Brian McKenzie and Salt Lake County Clerk Lanny Chapman, thank you both for joining me. When we come back, another major proposal to change the cap on medical malpractice in Utah. We'll talk about that. Stay with us. Welcome back in. Now, here are some of the other bills making top headlines right here on Utah's Capitol Hill. Well, lawmakers are considering a proposal that would cap medical malpractice damages. House Bill 503 would limit damages of all kinds in these cases to $1 million unless the patient died. It would also raise the standard required to get punitive damages and require the plaintiffs to pay attorney's fees if the court finds no merit. Now, the bill's sponsor says it's about protecting doctors, but victims of medical malpractice say their costs are way higher than $1 million, and this will hurt them. Now, that bill is waiting on a vote in the Senate floor.
After Utah banned collective bargaining for teachers and other public workers, Governor Spencer Cox announcing a permanent statewide teacher salary increase. Now, the governor telling public school educators, quote, "We see you, we recognize you, and that Utah is good because her teachers are great." But the Utah Education Association called the move, quote, "political posturing," and accused the government of ignoring the reality facing Utah's public schools.
Well, that does it for today's Inside Utah Politics. Don't forget, if you have any local political stories you'd like to see, make sure you reach out. You can email insideutahpolitics@abc4.com. You can also follow along with me on social media, on X, Blue Sky, and Threads, Lindsay on Air. That's also my Instagram handle. Lindsay is spelled with an A. This show is also online in podcast form. Just search for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ertz wherever you get your podcast. And while you're at it, download the ABC4 News app. Find Inside Utah Politics. We're always on. All right, thanks for being with us, everyone. We will see you next week.